This is a Collider.com audio interview.
How are you doing today?
Good. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Enough press for you?
You know, I actually like it. I don't know why.
Okay. I'm glad you do.
Yeah.
So I guess let me jump right in and say that I really actually enjoyed the movie. And I wanted to know, how important was it for you to keep the film as real as possible?
It was really important to me because, sorry, I'm eating at the same time.
No, it's all
important to me because I was very interested from a character perspective in what would someone really do if they had this power? And, like, you could never do, you know, an honest character exploration in the world of Spider-Man or Superman or Batman. You know, it's because those worlds are not at all like our world. And like Jason Bourne, who's set very much in my world, meeting people like that I know, and like every character in Bourne Identity outside of Matt Damon is based on a real person that I know. And even the crazy people, like Julia Stiles' character, is based on a woman I met when I lived in Paris, worked for the CIA. And so, you know, I wanted to sort of apply the same logic to Jumper and have somebody who could teleport in our world. And it was important to me because I fell in love with the character of David Rice in the book in sort of the same way that I fell in love with Vince Vaughn's character in Jon Favreau's script. You know, I'm very attracted to kind of what I consider to be like truly honest characters. You know, I think I'm going to be judged harshly, you know, by many people, you know, for the morality of this movie. And the same way that, you know, Brad and Angie, you know, and Mr. and Mrs. Smith, you know, express no remorse whatsoever over, you know, killing people for a living. You know, David Rice does not exactly make a great role model for the, you know, especially since a lot of young people are going to go see this movie. But in the hands of a sort of more traditional filmmaker, the obvious story to tell is selfish superhero, you know, ultimately decides to save the world and become selfless.
See, that's a question I had for you. There was a scene in the movie where you see him watching the news with the people on the river and the announcer saying something to the effect of, you know, who can save these people? It's going to take a miracle. Did you ever shoot anything that had him doing a reaction to that, or was that just like a throwaway?
You know, I had him, you know, I had an extra moment where he turned the TV off. But it was never, you know, in even a possibility that he was going to go do it. And I love that that wasn't even a possibility. You know, there's something, I don't know what it says about me that, like, I love him for the fact that, like, it doesn't even occur to him that he should go save those people. And because I don't think I'm all that twisted in my life. Like, I'm not like some like tattooed filmmaker who, you know, hangs out on the Lower East Side and, you know, like, you know, is part of some satanic cult or something. Like, I'm like a nice Jewish boy from the Upper West Side. But for some reason, I'm really, I really fell in love with, this David Rice, and I wanted to go as far as I possibly could with it. I mean, you know, the movie with the TV, the scene with the TV is not in the book. The scene with him, you know, sleeping with, you know, using the power to have one night stands all over the globe and then teleport away, as opposed to having the awkward morning scene. You know, not in the book. Faced with, you know, a heroic moment in the Colosseum where, you know, Jason Bourne would stand his ground, and instead David Rice chooses to use his power to run away. Not in the book. But, you know, I wanted to see, for me there was something heroic about all of that. And it may be that, you know, David Rice is just doing things that the rest of us would think about doing but would never admit to it. And so some crazy way he's just being a little bit more honest.
And you mentioned the Roman Colosseum, and I actually wanted to talk to you about the fact that the film does take place all around the globe. And I think that that's something that's so important to add to why the film, to me, was so good, is that you see these people all around the globe. How much of a challenge was that to actually film in Rome, in Tokyo, and, you know, all the locations you had?
I can't believe we actually accomplished shooting this film where we did. Given that every location, like if I told you, you could pick any one of those locations and I'll tell you what the restrictions were on us. And like any one of you would be like, okay, well that sounds impossible, you know, but hopefully that was the hardest of them all. And it wasn't like, just pick one of those and I'll tell you what the restrictions are.
Let's talk about the Roman Colosseum because that blew me away.
Okay. Roman Colosseum, we were only allowed to shoot 45 minutes in the morning and 45 minutes at the end of the day. Total.
So what did you do in between the morning and the end of the day?
I would shoot. Well, first of all, we would start prepping at 3 in the morning so that when our 45-minute window started, we were ready. And then we would go shoot other things during the middle of the day, you know, not much. And then we would start prepping an hour or two before our 45-minute window opened again. Because, you know, you don't have a second to waste. Like, you need all the cameras loaded. You need everybody knowing exactly what they're doing. You need the actors to rehearse their performances. But we would go, you know, we shot the Pantheon. We would go shoot the hotel. We'd grab other pieces.
Well, I mean, this is interesting because I know that you're famous for shooting and then reshooting. And as a
option, that not open to me on the Colosseum.
Right, I was going to say to you, how did that affect you, you know, as a filmmaker? Did you do...
I'm basically like, I'll shoot and reshoot if I have the you know, if that option's available to me. But, you know, on Swingers, I couldn't reshoot anything, so I just got it right the first time. You know, so I'll kind of, you know, in my gut, I know what the restrictions are. So in the case of the Colosseum, I knew it was a one-shot deal, so we did more rehearsals to get it right the first time, whereas maybe, you know, if I have the ability to go back, I'd rather not over-rehearse it to take a chance at getting something truly fresh and original, but knowing that also I may have to go back and reshoot because we're not rehearsing.
So I actually wanted to ask you, the film has a running time of around 90-something minutes, I believe.
Yeah.
I wanted to know, were there any key scenes? Did you have a lot of deleted scenes on this, or was it all on the screen?
It's basically all of, there's like two deleted scenes. Basically, it's that we paced the movie up to, you know, it went from being 2 hours to 90 minutes without us really taking anything out of it by, you know, I wanted to apply, you know, hopefully this will make sense to you. When you first edit a movie, the characters, the first thing you do is you cut out what's called the shoe leather. So anything where someone walks into a room or walks out of a room, any sort of anything that gets a character from point A to point B that's not necessary. So you just try to cut to all the good stuff and get rid of anything that's, you know, that's not important in between. That's called cutting out the shoe leather, and that's how you usually get a movie from 2.5 hours to 2 hours, you know, your standard movie. In this movie, the characters themselves are cutting out the shoe leather because they're teleporters. Why wouldn't they cut just to the good part of the scene? So you're already starting with a movie where the characters themselves are going to be living at a pace equivalent to sort of a tightly edited movie. Then, you know, what's the role of the editor in the case where the actors are sort of doing the editing in the first place, where the characters are already editing, they're editing their own lives before you even get a chance to start as a film editor? So I toyed with both sort of keeping it in the actor's pace, and then I really felt like we should pace it up and try to communicate the speed with which somebody who could teleport would live their life. And, you know, when the film starts and David Rice tells us how many places he visited that morning alone, you know, the rest of the film is an attempt to try to communicate the feeling of what that really would be like. And so, you know, for an older audience, the ending may move so fast that they may not even know all the places that the finale action sequence takes place in. But, you know, it was really important for me to try to communicate the emotion of what that would feel like.
No, I think actually you did a really good job with that. And I really enjoyed the film. I wanted to know, you seem to really like this character in this universe. Assuming that the film does pretty well at the box office, would you jump right back in and do a sequel? And do you have any ideas for a sequel?
I actually have a ton of ideas for the sequel because this was a whole new arena for me. And so, you know, my mind was in overdrive and the whole time. And we, you know, most of the ideas I came up with, you know, we either could tease or just save for a sequel. And, you know, so it's, you know, this power can be used to leave this planet. This power can be used ultimately, you know, to go back in time. This power can be used, if you go and work for the government, you would be the ultimate, Jason Bourne.
See, now, where in the movie you mentioned time travel, was that, did you drop any hints of that in the film? Did I miss this?
No, but there's one massive hint in the film for the ultimate twist that would take place in the sequel, which is, you know, I guess people will read the second book, so they'll know, but Rachel Bilson's character learns how to teleport in the second in the second book.
So you're saying that these powers can be taught to other people?
In this case, they are taught, and it's, you know, one of the things that may sort of, you know, one of the things that we toyed with on this movie, and you know, there is, you know, do we need to actually do the obligatory rules scene? You know, where you lay out everything the power can and can't do. And we ultimately decided to, you know, say, you know, we're changing so many other sort of aspects of this genre. Like, let's not do the rules scene. And because, you know, the rules don't ultimately, you know, the limitations of this power aren't ultimately... don't factor into the finale. So, you know, we skipped the obligatory rules thing, and also because this film is set in the real world, and David Rice is not a physicist, he is not going to understand why he can teleport. He will never understand that. You know, different movie if you get a MIT quantum physicist who discovers they can teleport. That guy will spend the movie conducting experiments on himself to understand it and understand how it's happening and what its limitations are. David Rice, not going to understand his ability to teleport the way Jason Bourne will never understand his amnesia.
We have time for one more question.
Well, I might as well, if I'm doing one more question, I might as well ask you, so what is your next project? Because I read online that you might be doing something, a moon project.
I have two projects I'm currently developing. One of them is with Jake Gyllenhaal about a private expedition to go to the moon present day. and it's what would it, you know, I think, you know, when the United States of America put a man on the moon in 1969, that really was, you know, one of the greatest accomplishments mankind has ever done. And rather than tell that as a historic movie, it was like, you know, can I make this relevant to a modern audience? Can I have modern characters today follow the blueprint of Apollo and recreate the Apollo mission today using parts stolen from the Smithsonian Museum?
Okay.
And so it's kind of an action adventure on the surface of the moon. And the second film is the story of Valerie Plame. You may know as the CIA officer whom the Bush administration exposed her identity.
I totally know.
And that's with Nicole Kidman. And that project sounds straightforward, except that I have a take on the material that, if I go do it, would be the most radical and revolutionary move of my career.
Oh, well, then I'm sorry to ask, but you need to tell me a little bit more than that, please.
It's so outrageous that it's ultimately, it's so outrageous that the way I look at it, I'm taking material that could be, you know, could just be a docudrama, and I'm making it into art. I'd be doing, you know, ultimately what a filmmaker should do, which is not just tell a story, but push the boundaries of storytelling.
And absolutely. Do you feel like one of those might win out over the other, or it's just which script comes together first?
It's which script comes together first.
And
you know, it's a, you know, I'm feeling a lot of kind of family pressure to sort of tackle more serious subject matter. Like, basically, you know, it's kind of my mom feeling like I should grow up. So, but I can't help it. Like, you know, the idea of transporting an audience to the surface of the moon and trying to give them the experience that Neil Armstrong had.
Well, you're also in the very rare position that you can make these big movies, that you, the studios believe in you as a filmmaker. And, you know, you have that, again, it's like you've won the lottery. So, of course, you should do whatever you want to do, to be honest.
It doesn't feel like having won the lottery. Like, I know, like, you know, sort of you step back because, like, it doesn't get any easier. Somehow I feel like if you won the lottery, it would be easier. Like, in either of these cases, like, I still have to toil on these scripts the way, you know, I had to toil way back when. Like, it didn't, like that aspect, like, just the movies don't get easier to make.
Well, I'm sure you feel even more pressure with the inflated budget, which leads me back to, would you ever make a film that would premiere again at Sundance, you know, or, you know.
Yes.
You know, because that might make your mom happy.
Hey, like, my favorite parts of the shooting of Jumper were the ones where we were back to a Swingers-style production, and, you know, because, you know, Hayden Christensen, you know, like Matt Damon was on Bourne, these actors were willing to run around with me with just a camera. And, you know, basically the look and feel of Bourne Identity stem mostly from the fact that I was, you know, running off and shooting with Matt with no permissions, and therefore the camera was, like, hidden under my arm, and, you know, we were, you know, worried about getting busted, and we'd have to move really quickly, and, you know, that ended up becoming a style for the whole franchise. And, you know, on Jumper, I wanted, you know, we shot in 17 different cities, and, you know, only in about 7 of them could I actually afford a real crew. And in 10 of them, I was going, you know, gorilla.
So do you think that the Bourne movie helped you with Jumper, with that ability to gorilla style it?
Yeah, I don't think if I had done it without Swingers, I never could have done Bourne. And without Bourne, I never could have possibly conceived of going guerrilla in as many countries as we did in this movie. And ultimately sort of, you know, having, you know, kind of, I also have a sort of a real desire to experience life. And so I was not afraid of getting arrested during the production of this film. In fact, if anything, I left Tokyo a little disappointed that with the number of laws that we broke in that country, I didn't get to experience what it's like to be in a Tokyo jail.
Do you think the government, though, was happy that you were having these stars and making a big movie there, though? That you sort of had...
No. I mean, they were... I might yet have that jail experience when I go back to Tokyo for the Tokyo premiere, for the Japan premiere, because when they see the footage and they're like, okay, you didn't have permission. Like, I know, you know, the police chased us while we were shooting that film on a number of occasions when we were shooting in Tokyo, and we just always got away, which is why none of us ended up in jail. So somewhere, someone's like, they're still looking for that Mercedes convertible, right? Like somewhere, someone must have a record that the Mercedes convertible got away, and they're, you know, they have the license plate and they're looking.
When you shooting that sequence, how many did you have? Just one camera? Did you have a crew? Was it guerrilla?
It was guerrilla, but it was like big budget guerrilla. We had a camera bike, so it's a motorcycle with a remote-controlled, gyro-stabilized 35mm camera attached to it, and a microwave link to a follow van where the camera operator was and where we were. And then there's the Mercedes being driven by a stunt driver, and we're going through the streets of Tokyo at, you know, 80 miles an hour.
And you didn't have permits?
No, they wouldn't let it. We got to Tokyo, and they were like, oh, sorry, everything we told you could do here, you can't do any of it. Mercedes coming out of the dealership? Sorry. Like, what do you mean, sorry? We're in Tokyo because we planned these things, and you said when we got here we could shoot them. They're like, yeah, we were wrong. Can't do it. Can't put a camera on the street. What do you mean you can't put a camera on the street? Yeah, you're not allowed to put a camera on the street in Tokyo. You have to shoot on a soundstage if you want to come. I was like, we didn't come all the way to Tokyo to shoot on a soundstage.
Well, on top of that, Lost in Translation shot there on the street.
They stole everything they did, but that's people talking on the street. I got a car coming flying out of a dealership that's got to land in the middle of an intersection. They're like, yeah, no. Yeah, for sure you can't do that. So we just did it.
That's absolutely crazy. I actually have one other question as a filmmaker. You mentioned you were shooting on 35. Do you ever think that you'll go digital, or are you always going to be a film person?
We did shoot most of the movie on 35, but towards the very end, I started using the Red camera. Are you familiar with that?
I'm not familiar with the Red. I'm familiar with the Genesis.
We tested the Genesis, but it was too difficult. The Red camera was developed by the guy who started Oakley Sunglasses. And so we were the first movie at Fox to shoot with this camera. I mean, it was a prototype. Like, you'll see on the website for the film, some behind the scenes, the surfing scene where I'm shooting with the Red, and you'll see I have like a hood over my head because there wasn't even a viewfinder for the camera yet. I had to use a monitor. I fell in love with it, and the same way that I love the Aton, which is a really small 35mm camera, the Red gives me that same level of flexibility, and so it seems unlikely that my next film would be shot on 35mm.
And with that Red camera, can you shoot with super low light and
No, you know, nothing shoots low light better than film. People are always like, oh, digital, you can go lower light. It's not really true. 35mm film is actually remarkable, and it's, you know, I shot Swingers all in available light, you know, in 35mm, and film stock has gotten significantly better in the last 10 years, so you don't get any advantage there. But 35mm film stock is basically so good that you don't really need movie lights.
So then what's the advantage of the Red camera? What is the added value that you as a filmmaker find, you know, why you'd move to the digital, you know, realm?
You can reload in about 10 seconds. So it's really hard to compete with that.
Okay.
You know, you have momentum on the set, and suddenly you have to stop to reload. You know, and everybody, suddenly the actors are in the bathroom, and you got to get everybody back. So just the speed with which you can shoot when you can reload in 10 seconds. The camera's smaller, which just gives you more flexibility. You can get it into more interesting places without having to, like, cut holes in cars and sets. And for me personally, since I operate myself, the notion that somebody else can be reviewing what I'm doing and telling me whether it's all in focus, as opposed to having to wait till the next day when it's too late to fix it, that's obviously very specific to me because most directors don't operate. Or if they can operate, they're better at keeping focus than I am. So for all those reasons, it's, I'm an easy convert to digital.
Yeah, and I know you probably have to go, and I so appreciate you giving me your time, but I also wanted to ask you about 3D filmmaking, and if that's something that you would ever consider for any of your future projects.
Yeah, no, the guys who did the U2 film had me come look at their technology, and, you know, it's a little cumbersome, and I'm still not sure from an emotional point of view, how I would use it, but it's something that it definitely intrigues me. You know, intrigues me because it's like, I also like a good challenge, and it's like that's, you know, it'll be a whole new arena for me. So, you know, it's very likely that some point, possibly even the Moon Project, I'll not only try to tackle a new arena, I'll throw in 3D just for the hell of it. The same way that, you know, doing Bourne Identity, it wasn't enough for me to jump from Swingers to a big studio action film. I also had to shoot it in France with an entirely French crew and teach myself French to be able to communicate to direct that movie. Like, 3D sort of feels like the similar kind of, like, got to learn a new language.
And my last question for you, I don't know if I actually got an answer from you about you explaining the time travel aspect of Jumper. I think you were talking to me about how in the next movie, Rachel might learn how to jump. But I don't know if you actually told me about the time travel thing. I kind of wanted to follow up on that.
Well, you know, the kind of jumping that we're showing in the movie, which is kind of a wormhole jump, which is why those scars are left behind. You know, if you can travel through space through a wormhole, from a scientific Einstein point of view, you could also travel through time. So, you know, that's not quantum teleportation, which featured in the film. And, you know, so I'm very specific to show those scars and show that, you know, you are leaving a wormhole. And, in fact, that's what Rachel Bilson gets pulled through in the end. So, I've left the door open to time travel because of the specific kind of teleportation that I chose to portray in this film.
Okay.
That's all the time we have.
Yeah, I totally understand. Doug, I so appreciate you giving me your time, and have a great day, and I hope the movie does very well.
Talking to you.